4 o'clock Thursday afternoon. Welcome. We are here live from the Hudson Valley and sponsored by Hearst Ranch. This is Severin. I'm your host every week talking to young farmers around the country about issues relevant to them and hopefully relevant to you. Today I'm joined by Sam Comfort of Anarchy Apiaries. He actually has his bee operation all over Dutchess County in southern Columbia County, and has a bee yard here on Smithereens Farm, so we get to see him quite often. Sam, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Severin. It's great to be here.
So, Sam, let's start with how you came to be into bees and what it means to be a beekeeper to you now in this place and this time. Go.
Well, things are pretty exciting these days. Things got very exciting for me after I won 6 beehives in a poker game, which is what I say. It's not exactly true, but it's the best story I've come up with so far. Actually, I went to Bard College. I was an art major and started playing with sticks and mud and wanted to go into agriculture. Through friends, I was pointed towards bees. I started at Honey Gardens up in Vermont, where I could park my van out back of the honey house and camp out and learn about bees for the season. That fall, all my friends moved to Brooklyn, and I moved to Montana, where I spent 4 years on and off working for a 5,000-hive migratory outfit doing almond pollination in California and apple pollination in Washington and cherry pollination around Flathead Lake, actually moving the bees with forklifts, 4 hives per pallet, about 500 hives on a semi-truck, a giant net over them, and you kiss them goodbye down the road 2,000 miles going to California to rent out to the almond growers for big bucks these days. Beekeepers really, the large-scale beekeepers aren't making a living selling honey with so much honey coming in from China and Argentina, so basically they are moving their bees around the country. Even from here in New York, they ship them to California every February to pollinate almonds, or up to Maine for blueberries in May, then cranberries and the mid-Atlantic states, and down to citrus in Florida. It's basically a rat race with insects.
So even with all the company of the buzzing ladies, doesn't seem like you're the rat race type. Tell us about the alternative to such an industrial beekeeping operation, and why others might be inclined to get involved in that other kind of pollination service.
Well, after seeing years of darkness and death and watching bees going downhill because of so many pesticides and so much malnutrition from monocultured farming, not a diverse diet for the bee families, I was fed up and couldn't condone putting medications in the hive anymore and didn't want to support that kind of farming. So I came back to the Hudson Valley at the same time that the bee collapse story was hitting the media. Bees have been going downhill for decades ever since they've been pushed to meet the demands of farming and are facing our land use issues with the pesticides. So it's the collapse story is nothing new, though we have unprecedented public support these days for our insect communities. Beekeeping is trendy these days, so we are at the forefront of an awareness movement. Once you get into bees, you are connected to your entire ecosystem. Wild land has a whole new meaning.
Let's talk a little bit more about the pesticides and the land use issues. When we're talking about the almond pollination that's going on in California, which has been beautifully documented, by the way, in a film called Pollen Nation, made by a wonderful woman named Singali Agnew, who's a dear friend of mine, an ally in a Greenhorns project. She managed to get an airplane to fly over Almond Country in and around the Northern Central Valley. And if you don't know it already, 80% of the world's almonds are grown in almost one contiguous block in Northern California, and or not only Northern, Central and Northern. And what that essentially amounts to is one big boom town of blossoms, all of whom need attention, immediate attention, by these very deliberate and hardworking creatures. And there is a certain amount of chemical input that is required by a system that is so intensive and so extensive as that mega monoculture of almonds. So visualize, if you will, hundreds of acres of almonds, and then the bees dancing in and out of these beautiful white blossoms. What's going on overhead? What is being sprayed, Sam? Tell us about the chemies.
Well, it's pretty ridiculous these days that there's so much control in our land use that you go to the San Joaquin Valley, where I went with the bees, you see miles and miles of sand and nutrient solution and almond trees. So the bees are carted in there from around the country because there is no other forage for them throughout the year. They'll do well on making almond honey when the bloom is on, but once that bloom is done, the bees will start to starve right away because there are no other flowers for them. So they are carted in and carted out within a matter of a couple weeks. And in almonds these days, and most crops that require bee pollination, are heavily regulated for their pesticide use to protect bees. And these days, growers know the importance of their bees. They're paying high prices for pollination fees these days. But it's really the number one user of pesticides in this country are still private landowners who are after their perfect green lawn. And for the past several decades, the main pesticides in this country have been organophosphates, which were developed in World War II as nerve gas. We realized that they worked good killing insects, so we started applying it to our food until basically every pest that we were applying against has developed resistance and people were getting cancer. So Bayer Crop Science came up with a new line of systemic pesticides, which is like a synthetic nicotine. It works as a ground drench or a seed soak, and it shows up in every part of the plant. And now they are the most ubiquitous chemicals used, more popular than Roundup, the main one being imidacloprid, or IMD. These products, like Gaucho, Sale, or Merit, are used to kill grubs on people's lawns. But most crops these days are using these systemics, which not only show up in the crops, but also in wildflowers adjacent to cropland. They're showing high residual in the soil. And, of course, the Bayer studies say that the sublethal effects on honeybees are not a serious issue in the recent collapses. There are studies that say different. You just need to look at who's sponsoring the study.
So clearly there's some controversy here. And while the honeybee has become much more charismatic and PR familiar to urban eaters and voters and legislators who recognize the tremendous ecosystem services that they provide and you know, agricultural services, the value of pollination is estimated in the billions, I think. Animals can't sue, or insects can't sue for their rights in court, and we do not have a terribly good history of protecting animals from poisons. What has been the commentary and kind of intrigue with Bayer? I mean, has Bayer had to talk about their products' effects on bees? And if you could maybe mention some references, some websites or some books that people might go to if they're interested in pursuing that this topic, because it does feel like beyond us caring about the bees, we do need to do a little bit more research into what exactly is wrong if we are to get legislative change to protect our pollinators. you.
Yep, the bees certainly don't have the ability to sue Bayer, and apparently neither do the beekeepers, a group of North Dakota beekeepers having a standing lawsuit since the mid-90s, since they saw their hives collapse while pollinating sunflowers that were being sprayed with imidacloprid. Bayer Crop Science is a multi-billion dollar international corporation which, with heavy government ties that basically have a lot of sway with what legislation gets passed, and very powerful lawyers that can claim misapplication of pesticides and have set themselves up to be a rather untouchable company. However, in fear of the public view, they are working with beekeepers. A group of large-scale beekeepers have started Project APIS-M, which you can find out about on the Internet, and also they're working with the North American Pollinator Protection Campaign to create a dialogue and make sure their products are safe and to spread awareness and knowledge of how things should be applied that won't harm the honeybees. On the other hand, though, my course of action is totally grassroots. Rather than working from the top down, rather to take down this huge company, Bayer, we need to spread awareness and tell people to stop the spraying because there are so many alternatives. Basically, changing the way we cultivate our food and the way we appreciate our land, and bees being on the forefront of it in the media these days, can really change how we are working with our food production and distribution to stop the spraying.
So we know that bees are pollinating, and we understand that, you know, the birds and the bees are basically providing the concubine services to the plants. I mean, they are the facilitators of the mojo. And so all who eat depend not only on the sun and the rain, but also on the sexual activities of these winged creatures. Let's describe a little bit what that dance is, and like, here comes a bee in the air. What is she doing this morning? Back to you.
That bee is one of 20,000 different species of bees on our planet, at least that many, that have been around for over 100 million years. Fossil records show that insect pollination actually predates wind pollination in plants. What does that mean? Basically, pollen is how flowers have sex. It's how they spread pollen from one anther to another to spread their genetic information, because they're rooted in the ground and can't do it on their own. So what pollination means is seeds or fruit. It's an amazing just how many of our products and food or produce these days. We figure about 80% of the produce in America requires bees for pollination. Things you would never even think of, like carrots or onions, all need bees to produce seed, as well as alfalfa for cattle crops need to produce seed. All require bees to be out there.
So back to the bee, because here we sit overlooking the marine field, and right now I've got the end of the buckwheat, lots of cosmos, a whole bunch of flowering melons, and I'm wanting to describe like the flight of the bee. Like, what is she doing, and is it her? And by the way, it's the girls who do all the work, which is something that we won't get into right now. But so, like, for example, I have a we went down to West Virginia, and we're going to West Virginia again this week. But we also were in Kentucky, and we spoke with a beekeeper who's raising bees on ex-coal mining land. Her name is Tammy Horn. And she found that the bees were aiding the regeneration of native vegetation on this land, which had been, which the mountain had been removed. And then they crushed some rocks, and they put some topsoil, and they spread some native seed. But the bees were making an inestimable difference that they had done studies on. And so she was hired by the mining companies to do the reclamation, to facilitate reclamation of that land. let's describe how much pollen and how much, tell me what's going on with this girl. She leaves the hive. What does she do? She's definitely visiting my melons.
Yeah, bees are going to forage in a 6-mile radius around their hives if they have to. They're very efficient pollinators within 2 miles, which is a vast amount, thousands and thousands of acres, if you do the math. Bees really are the keystone of the diversity of our planet. And in getting away from the energy-intensive systems of carting bees around the country and having a sustainable bee setup in your backyards, which I highly encourage, is to allow for the bees a complete diet throughout their whole year. Here in the Hudson Valley, the main event of the spring is dandelions, which most people note as a weed. Dandelions being, of course, an incredibly medicinal and important plant and a very tasty one, and a very important one to bees and all of the native pollinators in the area. Clover being the main event of the summer, and late fall flowers like goldenrods and asters wrapping things up. But to keep bees in one spot year-round as they are healthiest, you need all of these plants blooming throughout the course of the year. To grow our food, we need the bees. And to have the bees, we need the wild areas, because in there, the wild areas, just for the sake of them being there, that's our salvation.
Well, speaking of salvation, I think we have to take a musical break. I want to make sure to thank our sponsor, Hearst Ranch, and to remind you that you're listening to Greenhorns Radio every Thursday at 4 o'clock. I'm your host, and we're going to go to music. Greenhorns Radio. I'm Severin. I'm your host. Radio for young farmers, by young farmers, every week, on the nose. We're here with Sam Comfort, the head of Energy Apiary, a fabulous, low-impact, sustainable, ag-oriented beekeeping association and business in the Hudson Valley. Sam has his bees here on the land that I'm farming and on the land that many of my friends are farming. He pollinates our households and deposits sweet goodness on our tables with alarming frequency. Bees are very productive, and we are happy to be the beneficiaries. Yesterday, my friend Amy Franceschini came from San Francisco. She did a little artist-in-residency pause here at the farm and was working on a project about radical agriculture and was visiting with Sam about his fabulous band. It's not a band. He's a beekeeper. He's not a band. But it's called the Beekeepers Association of Northern Dutchess County. And that is a group that Sam started, and it hosts monthly meetings. I wonder, Sam, if you wouldn't mind, tell us about your band.
The band is part of my vision of having a network of beekeepers out in the world. The future I see of our food being small, diversified organic farms, which will require pollination, a network of pollinators and small-time beekeepers. The goal is to have more beehives than televisions out there. So the band, the Beekeepers Association of Northern Dutchess, meets in Tivoli, New York, monthly, and we also host quite a few field days, picnics, potlucks, days out with the bees, going through the hives, looking at queens, making splits, and training to keep bees alive without any artificial crutches, any of the medications or artificial feed that is going on today. So it's a lot of fun. You can catch up with current events at the website, which is www.anarchyapiaries.org.
Very cool. And beautiful women are constantly apprenticing with Sam. If for no other reason than to get a date, I would encourage you to start to learn more about beekeeping. Let's talk a little bit, if you wouldn't mind, about the interesting shape that your bees have. Now, Sam is interesting in many ways. He's got tattoos of bees all over his elbows. But he also has and one on his knee. he also has a very unusual form of beekeeping. Not that unusual in many parts of the world, but around here, his beehives are not the norm. Sam, tell us about the top bar hive.
The top bar hive is an ancient style of keeping bees that goes against the ubiquitous commercial beekeeping method that has been popular since the 1850s. During the Industrial Revolution, beekeepers saw a profitable business emerging and standardize on a beehive shape and methods to go along with it, called the Langstroth hive, which has been spread around the world and is the most common form of beekeeping today, those normal box hives that get stacked up through the course of the summer. If you go to a bee business, a bee distribution company, that's basically what they're going to set you up with. There's a lot of inherent problems that over the past several generations have not been questioned in these kinds of beehives, which the top bar hive alleviates or ignores or dismisses or doesn't even go towards. One of them being artificial comb. The Langstroth hives, the box hives, give bees a fake foundation where they draw their wax cells off of to raise their young and store their honey. These frames are spun out in extractors, and the comb is saved year after year to give the bees more wax so they can make more honey in a profit-driven thinking. What happens is that this wax saved year after year is lipophilic, and it absorbs all the pests, pathogens, and pesticides that are out there. Being saved year after year, all these diseases started emerging when this style of beekeeping got around. The top bar hives use none of this artificial comb. It's basically shaking bees into an empty space and letting them do their own thing. Still totally inspectable and totally legal, but it's really a less invasive style where the bees just do whatever they want.
So let's get this more visual image for our wonderful radio listeners. Imagine a box, and imagine that in the box you have sliced bread, but it's not sliced bread. It's actually combs, and the combs are an inch and a half apart, which is the size of the body of the bee, and the combs are then drawn into cells by the bees. The flat panels of the bread are made bulky and SUV-like by the actions of the bees, who are making little capsules for themselves and their young and their honey. And those capsules then are scraped to take the honey out. In a top bar hive, what happens?
We harvest the entire comb when there is surplus to spare and let the bees draw their own new wax year after year, which they've been doing as a social unit for 80 million years. And we find that the bees that design their own homes in this way, rather than giving them a sheet of plastic, which is industry standard these days, it's almost like giving them a plastic skeleton with ridges on it, dictating the bees how to raise their brood, what size to be. This plastic that we've been giving the bees has actually been oversized, thinking bigger bees make more honey. The result is actual bigger bees. But when we shake bees into a totally empty box and let them go back to their wild state, they regress their cell size, and it turns out they can handle the parasitic mites and the secondary diseases that show up.
So in a sense, you're breeding smaller bees for smaller cells, and smaller, more nimbler, and more resilient bees. It's interesting that the cells being so, the cell structure having such a deterministic and bigger is better mentality. It's kind of like the lots that you see, the suburban lots carved out of our agricultural land in a pretty abusive way, in my opinion. And instead, we envision a future in which individuals would create enterprises and farm organisms that are inspired by the shape of the land and the indigenous flora of the land, by the particular geological formations and aspect that they find there, and that those individual humans acting in the long-term best interest of that of themselves and their place would design fabulous systems of abundance and life, and that if we had enough of those wonderful places, that we would have a sustainable food system. So in the same way these bees are making their own farm, their own domestic ecosystem within this box. Let's describe the box and how you make the boxes, because this is really interesting stuff.
The box is an ode to minimalism. It's constructed very cheaply out of rough-cut lumber that's sustainably harvested locally here. The box costs about $6 worth of lumber to build. You can build it with a circular saw anywhere. It's easy to make, and every spring there's swarms out there, so, I mean, or sprinkle some lemongrass in the box and you might have some bees showing up.
Okay, so we have the smaller bees in the smaller cells in their own free-form, delightful, self-contrived situation. What kind of bees are they? Where are these bees from? Are they American native bees? Are they some wild, crazy bee that we could also have in a tree? Or are they like us, from a diasporic tradition of Western expansion?
Well, since the modern commercial hives came around, which allowed easy inspections and artificial manipulations, folks have been breeding bees, raising extra daughter queens artificially, selecting from a select group of genetics, basically the best hives, the one that produce the most honey, or these days the ones that are strongest in February to pollinate California almonds. What today's beekeeping requires, with the constant death of hives due to pesticides and malnourishment, what these industries require is bees that can be constantly split. So they want bees that are brooding all the time and constantly growing. This requires constant artificial feeding. Basically, these days, it's corn syrup as carbohydrates and soy flour as a protein supplement. So this artificial feeding, in conjunction with selecting from the bees that are growing all the time, has led to bees that cannot survive on their own. They're incapable of feeding themselves. They turn all honey and all of this corn syrup into more bees. If you have a large hive that's ready to pollinate almonds in February in California, if you have that hive here in New York, it's going to starve to death and not survive the winter. So the bee breeding that's doing all this happens in a lot of our universities funded for the industrial interests. And it's also focusing on in the southern states, the southeast, or California, or in Hawaii, where warmer weather allows it to bee breeding to go on year-round. These bees are then shipped up on semi-trucks here to the Northeast or other parts of the country every spring. Those bees breed with the feral population already established here, and those feral genetics are compromised. This has led to a frighteningly shallow gene pool all around the country, bees that cannot survive without the constant manipulations or, you know, medications, antibiotics. So what USDA did in lieu of the parasitic mites that were wiping out beekeepers over the past 20 years was import Russian genetics from Eastern Russia that had been dealing with this one mite, the Varroa destructor, for well over 100 years. The past 10 years now, we've been importing these Russian genetics, and what me and a bunch of other treatment-free beekeepers have discovered is that these bees aren't just resistant to mites, but resistant to just about everything. They have a wild tendency, they swarm constantly, and they're just robust and vigorous and lovely bees to have around. So we use a lot of Russian queens in our outfit, as well as feral stock that we get from doing removals from buildings and barns that need to be torn down. If they show promising viability, then they're incorporated into the breeding program.
So we're almost at the end, but tell me, how many different kinds of bees do you think you have in your collection, and how many hives do you have? You have 13 here, right? 13 here, and how many in total?
Oh, all around, and on 15 different farms here in Dutchess and Columbia County, we have about 300 hives. So we're busy, very busy, and just letting them do their own thing. And but to me, it's beekeeping is just the forefront of a whole awareness movement that's been going on right now. Everyone asks me about this global crisis that's going on with the bees, and really the less infringements we bring to the beehive, the more that we get out of their way. It seems that the more robust they are, the more morale they have, and the better they are surviving just on their own.
So once again, in case you didn't get it already, Sam's website is www.anarchyapiaries.org. Sam, any other call-outs you want to make? I know that Just Food has just concluded Pollinator Week, where they collected signatures to try and legalize beekeeping in New York City, I'm sure. If you're tuned into this, you're tuned into that. But any other organizations or associations you'd like to call out? Anarchy Apiaries has got a lot of books and references up on that website. And what was that fabulous book you told me about?
Eva Crane.
It's a book by Eva Crane.
The World History of Beekeeping
and Honey Hunting. I think it's quite a tome. So for all of you out there, hope this is useful, and please do get in touch with Sam and go on his website and research on your own. If this is something you're passionate about, I think we're going to need a lot more beekeepers as well as a lot more farmers. This is Severin. It's Greenhorns Radio. Thank you for joining us. Thank you to Hearst Ranch for sponsoring this show. Please do visit our blog, www.thegreenhorns.wordpress.com, for upcoming events, news relevant to young farmers, gossip, video ephemera, land opportunities, courses, and announcements about our upcoming event, Watermelon Moonshine, August 29th, here at Smithereen Farm. So, talk to you next week. Thanks so much for joining us. Bye-bye.